سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead," he said, "Do you not believe?" He said, "Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." He said, "Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise." Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39, and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, if the Israeli occupation entity had enjoyed the impunity and political cover of the U.S. for over the years, it would either no longer exist, be a fraction of what it is, and generations of its leadership would have been targeted and incarcerated for egregious violations of international law, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. But what we see today is a red carpet treatment of a wanted war criminal in Benjamin Netanyahu as he visits the White House. Not only is his arrest warrant ignored, but the four judges who issued it at the International Criminal Court, they get sanctioned. And the UN rapporteur on Occupy Palestine, who's documented all the war crimes in Gaza for over 22 months, she gets sanctioned. And ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan also faced sanctions back in February. And this is the focus of our Spotlight program. But first, let's begin with this report.
As global institutions pursue accountability for Israeli war crimes in Gaza, the United States responds not with support for justice, but with imposing sanctions and punitive measures. Washington is shielding its ally, the Israeli regime, from scrutiny and clearly emphasizes its unwavering support in the face of international law.
As President Trump and members of Congress roll out the red carpet for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a war criminal who will be remembered as one of the monsters of modern history.
So, is justice being served or silenced? In February, the U.S. sanctioned ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan after he issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and former War Minister Yoav Gallant. Their charges were war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Later on, Khan was banned from entering the U.S. and his assets were frozen. Then in June, four ICC judges were sanctioned for authorizing investigations into Israeli actions. The judges were accused of abusing power. Then the UN and ICC condemned the move as a threat to judicial independence. The latest target, Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. Her July 2025 report accused Israel of committing genocide.
Following nearly 6 months of unrelenting Israeli assault on occupied Gaza, it is my solemn duty to report on the worst of what humanity is capable of and to present my finding, the anatomy of a genocide.
The U.S. imposed sanctions on her, froze her assets and established travel ban after she criticized European nations for granting airspace to Benjamin Netanyahu for his trip to Washington despite his ICC active arrest warrant. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has described Albanese's efforts as illegitimate and shameful.
I've been smeared, attacked, I've received threats. And this has been relentless for the past 16 months. Me and my family, we have been all defamed and threatened, including my children.
International institutions are facing mounting challenges in their efforts and at serving justice and accountability. The tension between sovereign interests and established global norms prompts critical evaluation. Washington's blind support for Israel and shielding the child killer regime constitutes a blatant deviation from long-standing principles of international law.
And now for your guests. Mr. Yves Engler, author and political activist, joining us from Montreal, Canada. And Daniel Kovalik, human rights lawyer, joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, out of the U.S. Hello, gentlemen. Pleasure to have you both join us on the program. I guess, Yves, we'll start with you out there in Montreal. Yves, giving the Israeli entity political cover, it's one thing, Yves, but this outright demonizing, targeting, and sanctioning people with a mandate to adjudicate or document crimes, you're taking on a whole different task here. Help us make a sense of what the U.S. is doing by targeting these people, including U.N. employees here.
Yeah, the scope Washington's willing to go in terms of enabling the Holocaust in Gaza is absolutely remarkable. This latest move is obviously an indication of that. And the U.N. Should be moved out of New York. I mean, this is just another step down this pathway of targeting anyone, even if they are representing the whole international community, to help Israel commit more and more war crimes and slaughter against Palestinians. It's remarkable, but at this point, we have just seen one after another after another after another step down this path that Washington and its major allies have pursued in enabling Israel's crimes.
Right, and Daniel, welcome to the conversation here, and thank you for your patience. And also your initial thoughts as well, please, Daniel, on how the U.S. continues to kill the messenger here when the message and those involved in it, they encompass the most despicable crimes of wars against crimes against the humanity that this generation has witnessed.
Yeah, well, you know, a number of people have pointed out the incredible irony that in the same week that the U.S. has now recognized and lifted all sanctions on the al-Qaeda leader of Syria, al-Jalani, and removed his group from the list of terrorists, has decided instead to sanction human rights activists and leaders. It really says everything about where the U.S. is today. They are the enemy of international law, the enemy of human rights. And as an American, I couldn't be more disappointed.
Thank you, Daniel. And now, this week, Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine, she named 48 companies that are using the Gaza genocide to fine-tune their products and make billions from the onslaught. Tech giants, weapons manufacturers, heavy equipment manufacturers, banks, even charities, there is imploring them to boycott working with Tel Aviv. She also asked European countries just the other day to not allow their airspace to be used by Benjamin Netanyahu, a wanted war criminal, to get to the States. And he gets there ultimately, and then Donald Trump sanctions her, right, for this week's and other work that she's done in the past. I mean, in a just world, she deserves an award on her work for the Palestinian people, not the kind of scrutiny she's getting.
Yeah, well, Netanyahu suggesting Trump should get the Peace Prize for bombing Iran. Obviously, Albanese should be in any sane world would be a thousand times more proper candidate for that. I think that that contrast is just is remarkable that they. She's demonized, even though she's the one combating genocide. I think that the probably part of this timing is that was the report was quite impactful. I know here in Quebec, it got a lot of attention. The fact that the major pension fund in Quebec is invested in genocide, and he cited that in her report. Some of the stuff on the Caisse de dépôt here in Quebec. And that got a lot of attention, and I think that was probably, quite frustrating from Israel's perspective, and from Washington's perspective. So that's maybe one of the explanations for this timing of these sanctions. But yeah, in a big picture, I mean, it's the idea that the person who is putting everything on the line. In a sense, at least in the mental health or career on the line, not like Palestinians in Gaza putting everything on the line, but that they're targeted for doing everything they can to expose and to oppose these crimes, and then the criminal is celebrated in Washington for multiple days is quite a contrast.
And Daniel, your thoughts on the Trump administration sanctioning someone who has, to Eve's point, almost put practically everything on the line to carry out such a tedious task, Daniel, of documenting all of and opening the world's eyes to Israel's war crimes in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Now, this report we just mentioned with the 48 companies you mentioned the other week, that report was called From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide, and that comes on the heels of another lengthy report I'm just trying to outline how much time and energy she has exhausted on the Palestinian, especially this 22 months of Gaza genocide. That comes on the heels of another report called Anatomy of a Genocide, Daniel. That was from March of 2024. And another report in October of 2024 called Genocide as Colonial Erasure. Now, in the latter, Albanese identifies how Israel is expanding its genocide from Gaza to the occupied West Bank. Israel is the outlaw in this Wild West gunfight. And Albanese, she's the sheriff. What does that make, Daniel, the U.S. here?
Yeah, well, the U.S. is the enabler of this genocide. And Francesca Albanese is playing, if I may use a biblical term, really a prophetic role by calling that out. And as you say, giving everything, her sacrificing herself. By the way, I think as special rapporteur, I don't think she even gets paid. Maybe gets like a dollar or something for her work. I mean, this is basically volunteer work she's doing to advocate for the Palestinian people, to condemn a genocide, which everyone should be condemning, and then to be punished for doing that with these sanctions is outrageous. Again, it says everything about the people punishing her, right? She is the one who should get a Nobel Peace Prize. That is a no-brainer, right? And if she doesn't, it will be just an outrage, right? But we live in a time that, frankly, someone like George Orwell couldn't even satirize, right? It satirizes itself. War is peace. Again, as my colleague Eves pointed out, that you have this ridiculous show at the White House where Netanyahu shows him a letter where he's been nominated for the Peace Prize. It reminds me of when Hitler was nominated for the Peace Prize. I mean, it's that crazy. But we live in an upside-down world in which, you know, a lot of people's moral compass does not point to due north anymore.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
World Eve, the targeting of Karim Khan, also ICC chief prosecutor, and his team for issuing these arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu, his ex-war minister, Yoav Gallant, for crimes against humanity, including using food and starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza. Eve, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the ICC team. Please tell me what their crime exactly is here. Well, how do they deserve to get sanctioned? How is their issuance of these arrest warrants not praised and applauded instead?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, the criticism is that they've been way too slow and they haven't moved forward on this. Of course, they Karim Khan should be criticized for being way too passive in the face of Israel's violations of international law. But the Trump administration, goes after them like that. And I should say here, there's been two recent votes at the Human Rights Council, UN Human Rights Council, and the Canadian government, which claims to have been a big player in establishing the ICC and supports it, it has refused to endorse these two resolutions condemning these attacks against ICC officials. And in fact, previously, 5 years ago, I think it was in 2020, the Canadian government even sent a letter to the ICC, basically pressuring them, threatening the funding Canada's funding to the ICC if they investigated Israel's war crimes. So this is a, you know, the Trump administration has taken things to a whole new level. But this is kind of part of a broader pattern where any effort to uphold international law when it comes to Israel, that, you know, Washington specifically, but also Canada and some other NATO countries, that they target those who are slowly trying to hold Israeli officials accountable for what are, of course, vast crimes.
And Daniel, this is obviously nothing new. This is not something that's just restricted to this term. Donald Trump, we know back in his first term, he also went after another IEC team, canceling their visas. If you remember the time, that was, I believe, Fatou Bensouda's team. He canceled their visas. He told her he's going to sanction her and target her personally for going after U.S. war crimes and probing them in Afghanistan and in Iraq in his first term. Now, her name was Fatou Bensouda. And the funny thing is that at the time, Mossad director Yossi Cohen also was personally involved in a plot to threaten and pressure Fatou Bensouda to drop a Palestine investigation of war crimes back in Trump's first term, obviously committed by the Israeli regime against the people of Palestine. This is a systemic. This is basically the, what do you guys call it, the modus operandi for these two entities here.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it's just outrageous because when the West wants to wage war, they like to weaponize human rights to do that, right? And weaponize the ICC to do that. They like to use the International Criminal Court against other countries, right? Other world leaders like Vladimir Putin, for example, mostly against African leaders, right? It used to, in fact, some people joked it was the African Criminal Court. But they don't want it applied. They don't want the ICC's rules or its gaze to be applied to Western leaders, right? It's good enough for others, but not for the West. Even though, of course, Bill Clinton's administration played a key role in helping draft the Rome Statute of the ICC, and then, of course, refused to have it ratified. All these things just show the pretextual nature of human rights when it comes to the West, right? They use it totally opportunistically.
And that abuse as using it totally opportunistically, Eves, I want to put that to you. What does this do, the selective adjudication of international law and its application, who has to answer for war crimes and who doesn't? What does this do for the rule of law?
Well, there is no rule of law in international affairs, unfortunately, and the basics of international law are just violated. This isn't new. Of course, the U.S. has done this all the time, and its allies. You know, look at the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, obviously the invasion of Iraq in 2003, crass violations of international law. So this isn't new, but what we've seen in the past 21 months is a rapid escalation on that front. And I think to the point that Dan's making about you know, human rights just being completely politicized. I mean, it's just totally it's so crass how, you know, Canada's parliament will pass a unanimous resolution about supposed genocide in Ukraine, genocide against Uyghurs in China, and then enable the real genocide taking place in Gaza. You know, everything just, you know, continues on as if this government is designed, this country is trying to uphold human rights around the world. It's just the crass double standards are so flagrant. I think more and more people are seeing those, double standards around human rights talk. But if you pay attention to the dominant media in Canada, the U.S., it's only around the edges where the politicization of all this is discussed. It's throwing away, you know, the little bits of international law that that sort of were operational, and it's just might makes right. There's nothing. Israel's made it absolutely crystal clear that there's one policy. It's might makes right, and so long as they have the backing of the mightiest in the world, which we obviously see with these recent sanctions, they have. So long as they have that backing, they're just going to keep killing and killing and killing, and there's little that's going to be done.
And Dan, I'll also get your take on that. The impact of having the U.S. so blatantly try to erase the war crimes committed by Israeli leadership, try to prevent and even target individuals and organizations from administering or even trying to open the conversation to address war crimes being committed against a civilian population of over 2 million people. This cannot be good precedent, Daniel.
No, I mean, this is a frontal assault on about 150 years of well-settled international humanitarian law, right? The U.S. and Israel have been engaged in a systematic destruction of international humanitarian law, of the war, the law of war, since October 7th of 2023. Essentially, they are going out of their way on a daily basis to show that there are no limits, there are no moral or legal limits that they will recognize in terms of their behavior in prosecuting a war, right? And now we even see aid workers, so-called aid workers who are supposed to be distributing food, shooting Palestinians for sport, both Israeli and U.S. aid workers. It is absolutely disgusting. You know, I think it today is the anniversary, if I'm not mistaken, of the Soweto uprising in South Africa, in which about, I think it's 67 people were killed. And this really became a very important event, which really coalesced the world's opposition to apartheid in South Africa. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Israel's murdering over almost 100 people on average per day, after day. So you have at least a Soweto uprising type massacre
twice a day,
every day,
or multiple times a day.
And the world is doing nothing. Yeah.
Thank you both. Time has gotten the better of us. Thank you. Appreciate having you both on. Stay safe. To the both of you, Mr. Yves Engler, there joining us from Montreal, Canada, and Daniel Kovalik joining us out of Pittsburgh in the U.S. This brings us to conclude this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Questions and answers. In Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
How do we teach brotherhood to the children?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, a beautiful yet a very important topic in the religion of Islam. Because the first thing, what I'm going to say is about the importance of ukhuwa, or brotherhood itself. The Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salatu was-salam, we see them practicing brotherhood everywhere.
Yeah.
Because it brings unity amongst yes. people. Okay. One of the reasons, of course. So, we see the ukhuwa, the deal of brotherhood, which the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, amongst the first things which he has done after he came to Medina,
yeah.
in which he himself declared that he is the brother of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, yes. which is so beautiful, though. So, going ahead, of course, the Quran itself says the believer are the brothers to one another.
Yes.
This is there. And there's a hadith from Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. Shake hands with your brother because it will remove
increase.
Away, it will bring peace and it will remove the sins between you. Whatever sins are there,
yeah.
they're going to be removed
yes.
because of just a handshake.
Wow.
You see, like this warmth, this brotherhood itself, like example, if you tell your child, okay, you know what, go and make friends with the other child, okay? You know that the other child is a good person or a good child, yeah?
yeah.
Has good manners and stuff.
Impact on
yeah.
your
so,
child, yeah.
So, you know, and you know what? Recently, in the month of Ramadan, it happened that I saw a brother who was teaching his daughter, who was like about 6 years or something, and he was saying, and it was very beautiful. It was an eye-catching for me. He was saying his daughter, do you know who she is? Then his daughter was like, no, I don't know.
Then, I have no idea.
I have no idea. Yeah, it's the first time I'm meeting her. Then he, this brother, he was like, he asked that girl, like, in front of his daughter. He's like, do you love Bibi Fatima al-Zahra? Salamullah alayha. And the girl was like, yes, I love Bibi Fatima al-Zahra. And he asked his daughter, do you love Bibi Fatima al-Zahra? And she was like, yes, I love Sayyida Fatima, salamullah alayha. And do you love Imam Ali? Yeah. And he asked the same question. So you both have something in common. Then why don't you become friends?
Yeah.
And go and sit beside her, you see?
Okay.
So like it was something very beautiful. I was like, wow, like you are making friends just like that.
Mm-hmm.
This is like ukhuwa, like a kind of brotherhood, a sisterlyhood amongst the believers.
Yeah.
Which is very important.
Important.
Yeah.
So, especially in today's world.
In today's world. Yes, of course. Indeed. Yeah. So there's a lot of emphasis from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam on this particular topic of ukhuwa, which they, just like I've stated, like what Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasalam has done.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to siblings, especially, yeah. this becomes more dense and it becomes more eye-catching.
Right.
It's not just with the believers that they are brothers. Example, their siblings, even they are brothers. Like,
yeah.
of course, from own
of
from
course.
One blood, I would
yes,
say. Yeah.
Yes.
The brotherhood should be the strongest over here. And what a parent can do acts a very important role. It is it is more eye-catching. It is more important for the parent to see towards his own children, like how he is managing brotherhood between them.
Right. Now it's becoming more interesting because from natural brotherhood to from others, like from the society to your own siblings. Let's ponder on that, just reflect on that, and we'll take a short break.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman, don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim. يحب المحسنين وخالقنا وراسقنا وهو على كل شيء قدير.
Welcome back to your listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas is here, and we are discussing the importance of teaching brotherhood to your children. So mostly things are taught to children not by saying, not by lecturing, but by action.
Mm-hmm.
So when you yourself are an isolated person and you expect your child to be a social person, to have that brotherlyhoodness with others, maybe the results are not going to be as you expect. Because yes. Mostly the children learn from actions.
Yes, definitely. So example, if it is your own children, there are two, be it a brother or sister or brother or sister, doesn't matter over here. Instilling the sense of brotherhood is very important. Instilling the love of brotherhood, the fact that we are siblings, is very important amongst them.
Yeah.
And if they fight by any chance, which is normally common, it doesn't mean that, oh, they hate each other.
Yeah.
It is very important how you intervene amongst them, that the brotherhood amongst them is not spoiled. Mm-hmm. Example, if I give preference to one child over the other, their brotherhood might get affected. Yeah, might get degraded, I would say. For example, if you give a gift to one of them and you don't give a gift to the other, again, there's a problem. Example, if you praise one and you don't praise the other, there's a problem. If you kiss one and you don't kiss the other, there's a problem. You see, their brotherhood is gonna get affected. So, in order for you to instill brotherhood, there are don'ts as well. There are do's
and there are don'ts.
So you have to focus on both of them. You can't be like, oh, you know what? It's like they're going to play and I'm going to give them toys and I'm going to like make them go to this place and that place and it's done. Yeah. I have done my responsibility. No, it's okay. You're doing for them. But there are don'ts which you have to stop yourself from as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So example, one of the do's. Now I'm going to the do's. Okay. Example, what you can do is giving gifts to both of them, or a better manner. You give a gift to both of them. That's definitely important, okay? Because as a relationship of a parent and a child.
Yeah.
But they themselves giving gifts to each other is also important.
Oh,
so that the brotherhood is made strong, like is made stronger. There's a lot of impact amongst themselves. Example.
You remind me of my children.
Okay.
I gave pocket money to the elder one.
Uh-huh.
I have two sons. So I gave pocket money to the elder one. And he saved some money and he brought an ice cream for the younger one when he came back from the school.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was getting back the younger one from the school. And he was very hungry, like coming back from the school. And I brought his favorite thing for him mm-hmm. from the market. He so much wanted me to open it. And then he stopped me opening it. And I was like, why? He said, like, you know why? My brother, after coming from school, brought me something that I like. And I also want to take something for him. I was really amazed on this thing, like seeing what he got without us teaching them this.
Yes.
I was really amazing to see under 5 child saying that.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. You see, it's through the action of his elder brother that the younger one has learned
this.
Yeah,
exactly. So there's a lot to ponder on. There's a lot to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
And inshallah, may Allah increase this brotherhood among the mu'mineen. We'll take a short break here and we'll be back in a while.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing and Brother Liaquat Abbas is here.
And we're discussing the importance of teaching brotherhood to your children.
Yep. So example, what you can do is if the child is not sharing toys with his sibling, his brother or sister, what you can do is you can make a pact between them, a funny pact. And you can say, okay, now you're going to promise, like, I'm going to share my toys. Just like Imam Hussain alayhi salam used to share things with Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam. Example. You see the concept of Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam, because
You're introducing them at the same time? Mm-hmm,
yeah, because they used to share with one another, you are going to share your toys as well with your siblings. Example. So this is one of the methodologies where you can teach to share. You know, one thing is, when the sense of brotherliness and the sense of this brotherhood becomes strong, the moment the elder one, that is the father, example, passes away, the child become, they get this sense of parenthood. Example, there's a hadith where it is said the elder brother acts as a father in the absence of a father. Like if the father passes away, the elder brother kind of becomes a father for yes. the younger child, okay?
Yeah.
So for that thing to happen, a strong brotherhood should be there between them both.
Yeah.
That this is going to happen, yeah?
Yeah.
So coming back to this Islamic brotherhood topic, the lines of conclusion, I would say, is that never ever drop hatred between your children. Example, don't say, oh, you know what? It is your brother who has done this. Or it is your sister who has done this thing to you. Or example, yeah, definitely they have done something bad to your child.
But this is the worst thing you could do ever.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you are making things worse. Yeah. Instead of sorting it out, instead of winding things up between them
yeah.
and making them again back to normal life. Oh,
you're
making it worse. So never do this.
Yeah.
And when you bring a gift, make sure you bring gifts for them both as well, so that they exchange it between themselves. When you praise one, you praise the other.
Yeah.
And teach them to praise each other. Teach them to show love and affection towards each other. Inshallah.
Yeah. And that brings us to the end of another heartfelt session on Islamic upbringing. I want to thank Brother Liaquat Abbas for his valuable contributions and all of you for being a part of this beautiful community of listeners. Let's keep striving in our homes, in our hearts, to raise a generation grounded in faith, kindness, and emotional strength. May Allah guide us all and reward every sincere effort you make as a parent or a mentor. Until next time, this is Zainab, signing off with love and du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
In the old days, people that wanted to visit the city of Shiraz would go through the Quran gate. But nowadays, with the volume of cars, only people pass. Join me as I visit the city of Shiraz.
The Quran gate is the first thing you'll notice as you enter the city from the north, as two old copies of Islam's holy book was kept here in the past. Just at the entrance of the city also lies the statue of Haju Kermani, a poet and mystic from the 14th century. His poems are mostly about spirituality. His works are believed to have influence another Iranian poet called Hafiz, which we'll get to later in this program. Haju Kermani traveled to many lands during his time, but that stopped when he came to Shiraz.
The city of Shiraz is known for its poets and poetry. Many renowned Iranian poets lived here. Haju Kermani, when he visited the city of Shiraz, he never left.
This is likely because the rulers of this land valued arts.
The Arg of Karim Khan is a citadel built during the 18th century as the living headquarters of Karim Khanazan himself. Later it was a prison, and now it's a museum, which we can enter.
Karim Khan Zand founded the Zand dynasty and declared Shiraz his capital, and thus many buildings were erected in this city during his rule.
The architecture of the citadel combines military and residential architecture, as it was the home of Karim Khan Zand and also the head of his military headquarters.
But Karim Khan was different from other rulers of the time. When he came to power, he refused to be called king. He accepted the title the Advocate of the People, that is Vakil in Persian. Many structures built during his time carry Vakil in their name. Stained glass goes hand in hand with Iranian architecture. From homes to palaces, most windows were decorated this way. But it wasn't just for beauty.
The interesting thing about tinted glass is it's first soothing for the environment and for the eyes, and also it keeps the insects away, they say. I don't see any insects here, do you?
Next stop is the Vakil Bathhouse, a place where people from all walks of life would chit-chat and also bathe. At the entry, every part of the society had their own section, and many of the people's problems were resolved just here. It was like the city's or the town's informal council. And about the building itself,
bathhouse. And even in this building, which is a bathhouse, there's lots of detail put in the architecture. So this shows you how much Iranians valued every single building, even a bathhouse. Let's go and check out the rest.
Walking through this bath, I saw wall after wall of detail put in the making. And it's quite big for a place to bathe. But this also shows this place was more like a hangout or a place they would spend hours in. Not just a quick shower like we do today. And may I remind you, they didn't shower every day in the old days.
This place was way more than a bathhouse. Like for example, one person's having a scrub, the other's having a massage, and of course, one of them is bathing. And on the other side, there's one person getting a haircut, a shave, and that guy there got his tooth pulled out.
The Vakil Mosque is another landmark of Shiraz. The 48 columns in its prayer hall, carved in spirals, are one of its outstanding features. Next is Bazar Vakil, a big market still in use today to find everything from Shiraz and beyond. From spices and herbs to sweets and confectionery, and many, many more, this is the place to visit. You can find every kind of souvenir here, many cool things you can buy. And every quarter has its own goods. One unique part in this bazaar is where several hallways meet.
Okay, many of Iran's bazaars are similar in shape. But the difference for the bazaar in Shiraz is this little part here is called the Saray-e Murshid, where you can get your hands on many little things, like little antiques, little jewelry, or little souvenirs where you can take home.
Talking about cool things, there was also an antique shop that topped my list.
The Vakil Bazaar is one of the longest stretching and most famous bazaars in Iran. It is located in the center of Shiraz and is amongst Iran's national heritage sites.
Saadi, another one of the renowned poets of this land. He was born in Shiraz. He spent more than two decades traveling outside of Persia following the Mongol invasion. His works reflect upon the lives of ordinary people suffering displacement, agony, and conflict. His best-known works, Bustan, meaning the orchard, and Golestan, the rose garden, consist of stories illustrating the standard virtues recommended to Muslims, being justice, kindness, modesty, and gratification.
Saadi is one of the most famous Iranian poets of all time. His poetry is seen all over the world, not just in Iran. One of the verses that is seen in the UN building in New York is, "All men and women are to each other the limbs of a single body, each of us drawn from life's shimmering essence, God's perfect pearl. And when this life we share wounds one of us, all share the hurt as if it were our own. You who will not feel another's pain, you forfeit the right to be called human." This was just one.
And talking about flowers and gardens, the city of Shiraz is also famous for its Persian gardens. And in spring, the scent of flowers fills the sky in this city. The whole city is like a big flower shop. And last but not least is Persian poet Hafez. He was a spiritual poet and mystic known by his pen name Hafez. It means a person that knows the Quran by heart. It is believed that he also knew the works of Saadi, Rumi, and several other poets by heart too. His mausoleum located in a garden is where people gather to recite his poems, relax, and enjoy the environment. It's a popular hangout for artists in Shiraz.
Hafez, one of the most prominent Iranian poets of all time. While he passed away several centuries ago, still you can find his poems in the homes of Iranians today. So this shows you how important he was in Persian literature. Some regard him as the pinnacle of Persian literature.
And a goodbye from Shiraz. I'm Pedram Khaledadi for the Iran program.
Thank you. Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán recitadas por el señor Vaquefi.
ولئن أذقنا الإنسان منا رحمة ثم نزعناها ولئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات